You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk, and I'm Jose Dras Lopez. You can find all our previous shows as podcasts at psychtalkradio.com. That's psychtalkradio.com. Today on Psych Talk, we're talking about the voices in your head and how to change them. Our guest, Steve Andreas, is a writer and trainer focused on topics of personal change and communication. He's a prolific writer, and many of his writings have focused on a school of thought called Neuro-Linguistic Programming, or NLP. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, and he has joined to discuss his latest book, Transforming Negative Self-Talk, Practical, Effective Exercises. Steve, are you still with us?
I am.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've got a really cool book and what seems to me like a somewhat novel and very fascinating approach. So I'm going to let you just give us a little bit of background on the work you've done and how it's brought you to the ideas about self-talk in your book.
Okay. Well, firstly, I come from a background in chemistry, so I came to psychology a little bit kind of around the elbow. And I have a somewhat different way of looking at psychological processes and so on. A couple of things that I'd like to say just at the beginning is that self-talk is perfectly normal. All of us have self-talk. And more important, most of it is very positive and useful. You're just sitting in a chair and you think, oh, I better check the laundry, or some other instruction like that that is useful in serving you and getting your life together and doing whatever you need to do. So most of it is positive. Most people notice negative self-talk and think they want to get rid of it altogether. In fact, the Buddhists have been trying to get rid of it for at least 1,000 years. And a lot of psychological approaches advocate fighting it, arguing with it, and fighting against it. And those ways really don't work. It's a little like not thinking of purple bunnies. whenever you use a negation, it works backwards and makes them even stronger. So those are just a couple of things I wanted to say at the beginning. I'll leave it to you.
Great. Well, I think it's worth explaining your background a little bit more. You mentioned that you started off as a chemist and then got your master's in psychology. And it's always great to have a fresh angle on a subject matter where conventional wisdom might prevail, or most people might have a different background. But one thing that's different about where you've taken your career in psychology is that you don't just have a private counseling practice. That's not what you do. And that's unlike many other people who come on my show who just have individual paid clients coming in for problems. It seems like your focus is on training seminars, and almost you're providing research for other therapists to use and corresponding with therapists, as you do in your book, about their progress with particular cases using methods that you advise on. Tell us more about that. It's a little peculiar and very interesting how you're sort of a counselor for the therapists.
Yeah, that's a good summary. When you teach seminars, you get lots and lots of feedback. I do a lot of live demonstrations and seminars of the various methods that I teach. And I get a lot of feedback, not only from the clients, but also from the participants who are observing. One of the problems in private practice is that it's much too private. People do all sorts of things in private, and often the logic of that is confidentiality for the client. And while I can understand that, many people in private practice really don't get the opportunity for feedback, particularly direct feedback on what they actually did in a session. Sometimes they have supervision, but usually then the therapist describes the client to the supervisor. Mm-hmm. And that description is heavily biased by their own biases and predilections and theories and all the rest of it. And so they really don't get very much public practice and public feedback. And I think that's a real problem in the field as a whole. That's kind of a different topic, but I wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I did notice that you have a video on YouTube where you give an example of helping a woman through feeling down or depressed by working on a particular phrase in her self-talk. And so there you're opening up your methods to the public in a way. But I guess having a live audience is another way to do that.
That's correct, yeah. If you're in a seminar, often they'll speak up and say, hey, why'd you do that?
Right. There's also the danger online. Just when people are anonymous, they sometimes make somewhat inane comments, or they're not taking it completely seriously. So it's harder to filter that a bit.
Well, there is that, yeah, no question about it. But if somebody posts something weird, I can always just ignore it. But mostly people don't post, and that's, I think, the major drawback is that the feedback really doesn't exist.
Hmm. I'm just trying to imagine the group of people in there and what they're trying to get out of it.
Well, I've done seminars on particular methods. There are particular procedures that work, for instance, for grief or for phobias or for forgiveness, people who are angry and or resentful and want to reach forgiveness, or sometimes even if they don't want to reach forgiveness, then it's my job to convince them that it'd be a good idea before doing the procedure.
Yeah.
I've got a video online where I cure a gal's phobia in 7 minutes, and Steve Andreas' phobia cure will come right up, and we have 25-year follow-up on that lady.
Hmm.
Also on YouTube.
You said Steve Andreas' phobia cure is the search term to do. We should probably just jump into the meat and potatoes of the book.
Okay.
We have a little sense of, okay, you do training seminars, you do presentations, you're doing methods testing directly with clients and also by hearing back from therapists. All right, but let's just find out, what are these voices in our head? Is self-talk just the same thing as a hallucination, or is it just thinking in general, or how is it different from that?
Well, a lot of people talk about thinking as if it's only the words in people's heads. And I think that's restrictive. Thinking involves a lot of other things, especially visual images, even kinesthetic feelings. And I don't mean the emotional feelings, but the feeling of your hand touching a desk or something like that, as well as auditory sounds. For instance, if somebody sits down at a restaurant and looks at the menu, the decision process that they go through to decide what to eat might go something like this. They read hamburger on the menu, and they make a picture of a hamburger, and then they imagine actually biting into it and feeling the crunch of the lettuce and this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then the taste in their mouth and how it feels in their stomach, and then they go to the next menu and decide the menu item and decide how that one tastes and feels in their stomach. And eventually they'll pick the one that they like best. I mean, there's a variety of ways that people do that, but they all involve images and taste and so on.
Right. So that's to point out the variety of thoughts that we can have, that they're not all verbal. You're saying there's visual or just sensations.
Right.
Thinking right.
is a lot more than just the verbal thoughts.
Now, I asked about how self-talk might be different from just talking or hallucinations, because I think some people, like you said in the beginning, it's self-talk's a good thing, but people's first reaction might be, isn't that something a schizophrenic person would do and talk to themselves? I don't do that. I do something different. Or, how much distinction is there between a full-blown hallucination of like where you can't even tell it's in your head and just the everyday, oh, I should not have such a big lunch today?
It's a matter of a couple of things. One is the person's attention, where is their attention drawn? If they're really drawn to the auditory self-talk and it becomes typically louder and more important and more convincing to them, and particularly if the rest of their life isn't very interesting, they may focus so much on that that it appears to be as real as their external world or someone else talking to them, and then we call it a hallucination.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people that work with schizophrenics, and as they and they work deliberately in much the same way as I do in many sections of the book here, is that you make friends with the voice and ask what it wants for you and what it wants for you that's positive. And gradually the voice has become more reasonable instead of yelling at them and accusing them of all sorts of awful things. They become more friendly and they tend to get less loud, more soft, and gradually they become like everybody else's voices.
Yeah, so there's a potential for transforming the voices that will also help with deeper emotional problems or psychological problems. How do you start that process? What are some of the first ideas you try to change an internal voice that you've identified?
Well, one of the hallmarks of my approach is that I think psychotherapy is actually not a very good word. I think it should be psychoeducation. And so I teach people how to do things in their mind that they can learn very easily that can make a useful difference. And one of the first things I ask them if they have a difficult bothering them, I say, tell me where it's located. And usually it's located somewhere in or around the head. Sometimes it's the one side, or sometimes it's the back or the top or the front and so on. And then I say, okay, imagine that you hear that voice at arm's length away from you or something like that at a certain distance. Typically, when the voice is moved to some distance like that, you can make it 30 feet or 100 feet if you want to, the voice lowers the volume and becomes less intense. So that's an immediate way to take a hallucinatory voice or any loud voice that's really driving somebody's behavior into addiction or whatever, and making it much easier to listen to. And once it's easier to listen to, the person doesn't have such a strong emotional response to it.
Right, right. You mentioned that there's certain skills involved in dialing down the volume of self-talk or other modifications, we'll go more into, like changing the tempo, that might be easier for a musician or people with certain skills they've practiced elsewhere, or maybe an actor who's more familiar with accents and listening to tonality. Do you see a lot of variation in how responsive people are to modifying their internal voices, or are people pretty similar in how they pick that up?
People are pretty similar. You don't really have to be a musician. You don't have to talk about exactly what physical characteristics of the voice are going on. People do respond to this, and you just say, you know, well, imagine that self-talk voice that's accusing you of all sorts of things. Imagine it had a Irish accent or a Norwegian accent or a Chinese accent or a Mexican accent or something like that, and suddenly it'll sound different. And the tonality is very, very important in creating our emotional response. A lot of people and a lot of cognitive behavioral therapists think it's the words themselves that stir up the bad feelings. And they do have a part in it, but it's much more the tonality that really makes the difference. You can say something really nasty, and if you say it in a very loving, soft, seductive tonality, people respond very differently. In the same way, you can say, I love you, and if you say it like this, I love you, somehow the message doesn't get across very well.
Right.
It's the tonality that really drives the feelings for the most part.
Well, that's an interesting point, and one thing I notice about it is that tonality can be so much more complicated than just parsing the words. And makes your job as the counselor, educator, a little trickier. It seems like it takes a little bit more of a judgment call at times, because, like, let's say you changed the tone of a negative phrase to something more positive. It could almost sound mocking in the mind of someone who's predisposed to just always take it the wrong way. So I wonder if it's just a try and see approach that you have to keep seeing how a client reacts, or if there are some of those complications that you can anticipate, you know, if a person's going to feel mocked or something's going to backfire.
Well, at the very beginning of any session, I advise people to set a certain frame. And one of the frames that I set is, look, we're going to be experimenting here. I'm going to ask you questions. You're going to tell me about things that are going on in your head. And often I don't need the content, I just need I've got a nasty voice that's over here on my left or something like that, and I don't even need to know that it was a parent accusing them of some horrible crime when they were a kid or something like that. I don't need the content usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I also say, you know, we're going to try a lot of things, I'm going to suggest things, some of them will work, some of them won't work. It's your job to tell me which ones work and which ones don't work. Give me immediate feedback. And then if they get insulted by something, I say, oh, sorry, well, let's try something different. And I just apologize and back off and try something else, because I've set frames at the beginning that we're going to be experimenting, and I don't know which of these different methods will be most effective for them. And they need to let me know about it, and then that they will be guiding me in terms of what I might suggest next. And any response can be utilized. A lot of therapists are worried about insulting their patients or something like that. I don't worry about that, because right up in front I talk about I can't be insulted, and so they can be free to insult me if they want or say anything they want, and sort of by implication it goes the other way around too, that I'm not interested in insulting them. But if I do, I'll apologize and move on.
Right. You frame the session at the beginning as somewhat experimental. You're trying to get them into an open-minded frame of mind where they're not going to snap at you. Just if one thing doesn't work, they'll move on to the next thing. So that makes sense. One thing I'm curious about, as you layer on the different textures and tonalities of a voice that a person is hearing, is did the person initially come to you complaining about a voice or complaining about some aspect of voice, or is it usually you who initiates that as the focus of the session, saying, I think we should find a phrase that embodies some of the problems you're facing?
Well, I wouldn't say it quite like that, but yeah, often the people come in and they have problems and they don't realize the immensely important role that an internal voice plays in their problem. So I'll explore the problem and then find out if these methods or some other methods would be useful. But for instance, one woman I saw she came in saying she was having trouble with her presenting herself in her chosen field, which happened to be biofeedback. She was having trouble selling herself. Mm. And as we probed a little more, it came down to she wasn't feeling personally congruent. She felt like she wasn't, quote, good enough to do the kind of work that she was doing. She was convinced that the work was useful. She had good feedback, and she was congruent about the value of what she was presenting, but she wasn't congruent about herself. And it turned out she had a voice inside that said, I'm not good enough. And so then we worked with that voice. So it's a matter of exploring. Often people will start coming in with depression or something like that, and they don't realize how much an internal voice has to do with it. Occasionally somebody will come in and say, oh, I'm always criticizing myself, or I hate myself, or something like that. And then you can go directly to the voice, but sometimes you have to probe a little.
Right. And this idea that you can get to a voice that a person didn't notice also, to me, dovetails with your idea that cognitive behavioral therapy is maybe a little too focused on the words or the content of thought, because I'm reminded of the video I saw with you on YouTube helping a woman who was feeling depressed or had a similar sort of thought that she doesn't deserve love. And she mentioned, you know, I intellectually know that my thought doesn't make sense, or that
right.
There's a reason, there's an explanation already, like my parents didn't receive love themselves. And so she just needed a way to deal at an emotional level with the words or with the thought. And so I guess the first step is just finding a chunk that has emotional resonance and then playing with that, right?
That sounds good to me.
Well, I want to talk about the Buddhist idea of eliminating self-talk and the related idea of focusing on the present. I sort of want to handle that before we get to aspects of a voice. So there are, of course, some benefits to focusing on the present, that there might be certain distracting negative feelings that fade out. But what is your sense of what's good and bad about that approach?
About the Buddhist approach?
Well, especially focusing on the present, the sort of mindfulness and not thinking about the past or the future type of response.
Well, it gets a little paradoxical, because if I'm focusing on the present right now, part of my focusing on the present might be, oh, I'm remembering that event from the past. So the past can be included if it's actually present in the moment of someone's process. And so fundamentally, I think mindfulness is a good idea. I think it's to pay attention to what's going on in your head, because it makes a lot of difference in terms of your life and whether it's satisfying or not and all the rest of it. I think the popular idea of mindfulness is sometimes a little bit limited. I'm very mindful when I ask someone about a voice that they're saying to that where they're saying something to themselves. I'm mindful of the tonality. I'm mindful of the pitch of the voice, of the tempo of the voice. That's all part of mindfulness as far as I'm concerned. And that's where the real change occurs. As you mentioned, someone can have an intellectual understanding and it won't change their response. So what's really needed is to go below the intellectual understanding to the elements of someone's experience that creates the response. And as I've already mentioned, tonality is a huge piece of that. And if you change the tonality, you can change the emotional response. And then the intellectual understanding can come later.
As you're speaking about mindfulness versus your approach, I think it's worth mentioning that there are a lot of different ways of tackling a problem can be closely related. So I think the way you approach a session incorporates some ideas that are branded as mindfulness. For example, noticing how something makes you feel and then just letting that feeling sit there and having a little distance from it, you know, just sort of observing it. That seems, as you are helping a client gauge reactions to different interventions, that's part of what they're doing, right?
Right, absolutely. And distance is a huge advantage. And like any human skill, it can be misused. There are some people who are so dissociated and so distant from everything that's happening, they call themselves existentialists. And there was a Ziggy cartoon long ago that I always enjoyed. It said, "The secret of living without frustration and worry is to avoid becoming personally involved in your own life." It does work, but it's not much fun to be totally dissociated. However, most people have the reverse problem. They're so immersed in life. They're so responding to people around them unconsciously and directly and spontaneously and so on, that they have no control over their life. And somewhere in between, you can dance back and forth. So if you get in a sticky situation, you can kind of pop off to the side and look at yourself in the situation as if you were a scientist observing a couple of bugs on a leaf, and notice what's going on and see if you can think of something because there's less emotion when you're looking at it as a scientist. And then decide, well, maybe you could try this. And then you can step back into yourself and try out a new possible response. So a lot of flexibility and creativity in responding to life is founded on being able to be objective. That's what objective really means. Objective means you step out to the side and look at something as a scientist might.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, while we're talking about balancing distance and involvement and being objective in assessing our life, I'd like to jump to a thought I had about the usefulness of a voice, whether it's positive or negative. Sometimes a negative voice might have information in it that we should listen to, or a positive voice is sending us in a bad direction. So how do you encourage clients to hold on to a healthy dose of realism without being overly optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, realism means that it now fits in the real world. And somebody, let's say, is overly optimistic, I say, well, let's spin a scenario. You think it's wonderful, this guy is wonderful, and you'll have a happy life together, and you want to jump into bed with him or get married right away. Let's spin this out a little bit. Run a scenario of being with this person on into the future, let's say a year or two, and let's see how it works in terms of, in your mind, check this out, does it really fit? Now, sometimes just doing that and just giving them a larger scope of experience to evaluate makes a huge difference in their opinions. On the other hand, you can do the same kind of rehearsal. Essentially, it's a rehearsal, and there's all sorts of scientific evidence now that rehearsal really is useful, from basketball to emotional things as well. That if you rehearse a response into the future in the context in which you want to have it, that it's a really good way of testing whether it will work or not. People's unconscious minds are immensely creative and detailed. They notice all sorts of stuff that our conscious minds don't. And if you imagine a future scenario behaving differently, whether positive or negative, that's an evaluation. But it's just a thing. And that's what we do all the time. We imagine, well, I could do this or I could do that. Well, what would it be like? And we actually rehearse into the future spontaneously. To do it really systematically is quite a good check and balance on reality constraints. Ultimately, the only real test is in reality. So ultimately, people have to try something out in reality and find out whether, in fact, it works the way they anticipated it might.
Right. So in one sense, imagination is a great place to do reality testing, but then the counselor or therapist or educator partly is just helping the person check in with themselves and remember to reflect on whether things worked out the way they expected.
Do the same thing kind of into the past. You can say, okay, I want you to remember a past situation where you jumped in with all 4 feet and didn't work out too well. And what can you learn from that? review that movie and just notice all the feelings you had, the words that were spoken, the things that occurred. What can you learn from that might be useful in a future decision of that nature? One of my favorite quotes is that part of life is transforming hindsight into foresight. You can go into the past and sort of mine it, data mine it, for good information that you can then apply to the future. A lot of people just don't do it often enough.
Right.
It's a great way to do it.
Yeah, and there are a lot of great quotes about hindsight and using it as a resource. I'm reminded that in our area here in North Carolina, we have Duke University, and we have a local researcher named Dan Ariely that does behavioral economics. But I find funny that he named his center the Center for Advanced Hindsight, when he could have named it Center for Advanced Foresight or whatever else. There's a little humility in it, but it's also just a reminder that we have a lot of data to mine if we're willing to go back and process what's happened.
Immense amount of data. Most people don't do it often enough. They may ruminate on past mistakes, but they don't do it in a way that's useful, where they can really get the information out that could be useful in the future. They just kind of go over the same tape loop over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a certain repetitiveness and restrictiveness to the way people tend to cycle through their experiences, right? Or the sort of scripts they have for interpreting things.
Right.
So, of course, you're there to change some of those scripts. And let's jump back into some of the concrete examples again. I mean, for example, just the woman who was saying, I'm not good enough. She felt that, I'm not good enough. You were helping her with volume, or one thing is to look at the location of a voice. So walk us through how that would work to think about a voice's location.
The principal thing is to get some distance from the voice so that you can really listen to it and evaluate it. And in that particular woman, I asked her if that was her own voice or her mother's voice. And she said, well, you know, I hear it as my mother's voice, but she never actually said those things to me. What she actually said was encouraging things like, you can do better, you can do better, you're smart, you can do better, blah, blah, blah. And she took the you can do better as to mean I'm not good enough. Now, her mother, I'm sure, was well-meaning and wanted her child to have a successful life and was trying to encourage her, but the words she had had the opposite effect. So part of the work with that particular woman was to have her really, really recognize that her mother had good intent, that her mother loved her, and that she just was a little clumsy in the way that she spoke her words, and that she really wanted her to do well. The other piece that I used there was, and this is very often the case with these internal voices, is there's a huge deletion. When you hear a voice that says, you're not good enough, one of the things that's deleted, who's talking? Who's giving this opinion? You're not good enough just sort of exists, sort of hanging in space. The other major deletion, and that's what really made the crucial difference for this particular gal, is you're not good enough for what? And when I focused her attention on that, she started laughing and she said, well, I'm not good enough for, and she filled in the blanks, did a sort of a sentence completion thing with a lot of things that she was clearly good enough. I'm not good enough to go to the grocery store. I'm not good enough to comb my hair. I'm not good enough to brush my teeth. And she started cracking up. And all the way home from the session, she kind of went through this, I'm not good enough for what? And she just kept filling in the blanks. And it was kind of like a spontaneous homework that she did, where she kept filling in the blanks with all of the other things that she was clearly good enough for. And it just kind of blew it apart. It just made it sort of meaningless.
Right. So you started by asking whose voice it was, and she said, I guess, sort of like her mother's. And one interesting thing you're doing there is preventing her from thinking just, I am not good enough, right? It's coming,
right.
It's external. So tell us about why it's important to shift toward a you are statement versus I am statement.
Well, an I am statement is so tight. Number one, it's a statement about being. If I say I am this person, that means that I it's part of my existence, it's part of my nature. Whereas if someone else is talking and saying, you are, it's a little different. It's a little more distance because the criticizer and the criticizee are separated by some space. And it becomes more obvious that this is one person's opinion. Somebody else might have a different opinion. And you can even do that. You say, okay, your mother says blah, blah, blah. What does your father say? What does your sister say? What does your brother say? What does your friend, your best friend in high school say on this particular topic? And you can make it clear that there's a whole bunch of different opinions out there besides the one that they've been nattering to themselves about. And that alone can make a huge difference. It's a separation of the criticizer from the person being criticized.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows a potential for reorganization and reconceptualization of the truth that matters. And the other thing that a lot of people do is they may have failed in one very important respect. Maybe they annoyed the boss and got fired or something like that. They started thinking themselves as, I'm a loser, as if it were a huge generalization. Well, which it is, it's a huge generalization. Instead, if they stay with the fact, boy, I sure screwed up with my boss and now I have to look for a new job. That was a mistake I don't want to make again. Let's take a really hard look at how I did that and why it didn't work. So I won't do it again. Again, the hindsight into foresight.
Hmm. So sometimes it helps to just be specific.
Absolutely. Generalizations are the road to hell. They're useful and they're very seductive and they're very dangerous. Especially when applied to the self. Like somebody says, I'm a loser, nobody will ever marry me or something like that. When they're universal generalizations like that, I think it's Mark Twain said, all generalizations are sometimes false, including this one.
Yeah, Mark Twain was very good with those aphoristic statements.
He was sharp. I would love to meet him in the afterlife.
I think you had another Mark Twain quote in your book, if I'm remembering correctly, was, I've suffered many catastrophes, most of them never happened.
Yeah.
Was that you? Yeah, so that's a good one.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites too. This life I've gone through great many troubles, and most of which never actually happened. They only happened in his imagination.
Right, so that's a reflection of the way we can ruminate on things in a negative way. Well, you had this client we've been discussing whose mother actually maybe was more loving than the daughter gave the mom credit for. She had started to hear things in her mother's voice that were a little more negative than what was actually said. I think there are other cases where the parent more unambiguously said negative things. And one location-based exercise I saw you discuss was actually imagining walking behind the parent and sort of holding them on the shoulders and whispering into their ear. Tell us more about that, because this one's it's interesting in how involved it is and the image that is involved.
That's a lovely intervention from Andy Austin, who's a very, very bright and interesting guy. He's got a wonderful book called The Rainbow Machine. It's really a lot of fun. Someone says, I have this critical voice, blah, blah, it says blah, blah, blah. Okay, great. Who's speaking? It's my dad. Can you see him now? Yes. Look at his face. What does his face look like? Well, he's angry, and he's standing up in front of me, and so on. And then the intervention is to ask the client to imagine in their minds standing up, walking around behind the father, whoever it is, and put your hands gently on his shoulder and just say, it's okay, in a nice soft voice. And it's a way of allying with the voice. Most people think that a critical voice needs to be fought or needs to be battled or needs to be yelled back at. In fact, there's some people who say very nasty things back to their troublesome voices in an attempt to get them to shut up.
Hmm.
And that just doesn't work. But going around behind them and actually making physical contact is a way of allying with the parent. And often when people do this, they find out, oh, you know, this has nothing to do with me. My father was just totally wigged out. He was totally frustrated. He just lost his job. His best friend cheated him out of $500, and he's just totally at a loss. He's feeling totally inept and helpless. He's screaming at me because of what's going on in him, and it really has nothing to do with me. That's what people often discover. It's a matter of discovery. It's not a matter of me lecturing at them. I'm just using this as an example. I wouldn't say this to someone. unless they had already come to this conclusion or something very much like it.
Right. So that conclusion is a sort of cognitive reframing. It's, you know, reprocessing how they understand something. But you got to it not through just talk therapy sort of discussion. You got through this visualization, this whole walking through a scene using the full powers of the imagination. You know, how does it feel? How does it taste? Everything. So it's interesting.
Essentially, I get them to convince themselves of the truth of this by their own visualizations and what happens in the visualization. For instance, in grief, a lot of people who are grieving are very unhappy, and they're, my father died, and all this stuff going on and on like that. And a very easy intervention is you say, I want you to imagine your father's right in the chair there, and tell him how you're grieving now, and ask him if that's what he wants for you. Just open-ended like that. And almost invariably, the hallucinated, the imagined father in the chair says, I don't want you to remember that. I want you to remember the good times.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's the way out of grief, is to remember the good times instead of the loss. And there's, I've got a whole article on that on my website, which is steveandreas.com. A bunch of free articles there. One's on grief, one's on forgiveness, one's on shame. A bunch of good free stuff there. People want to follow up. SteveAndreas.com.
SteveAndreas.com. Great. Yeah, no problem.
I've also got a blog. If you Google Steve Andreas NLP blog.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll send our listeners to SteveAndreas.com, and they can also Google Steve Andreas, and they'll find your blog.
Yep.
So you're talking about helping people through grief by maybe imagining what the person they lost would want, and helping them come to their own realization. And it's interesting because by the end of that process, we already talked about how it's a cognitive reframing. There's no disagreeing that that's what any sort of therapy or counseling would want to achieve. So it's, there's, I guess, a pragmatic way of looking at this, which is just that it's worth experimenting with whatever might work for the client. And it seems like you do have a little bit of that tinkerer's type of impulse.
Yes. Well, sometimes I really know exactly what needs to be done, and then I just do it. The example of the phobia cure that's on YouTube, you know, it's less than 7 minutes from, hi, how are you, between meeting this gal and she's all done. And it's also very interesting, too, because at the end of I did a pretest at the beginning. I said, you know, imagine she was a phobic of bees. She'd fallen into a bee's nest when she was about 12 years old. Got literally hundreds of stings and had her whole body swelled up and so on. It really was a serious thing. And at the beginning, I said, imagine a bee came in now, and she goes, she freaks out. And then at the end, I said, okay, imagine one came in now, and she's totally consciously expecting to have the same old response, but she didn't, and it was surprising to her. And then I said, well, imagine it came in and landed on your hand, and she looks at her hand, and she goes, I said, what's it like? She says, it's like having one on my hand. And the conscious understanding has its uses, and we solve a lot of problems with our conscious intelligence, but the kind of problems that bring most people to therapy are not that kind. They can figure those out with their brains. It's the unconscious responses, the responses where someone says, you know, I really don't want to be addicted to porn, but I just keep finding myself at the computer dialing up the site, or, you know, I want to eat less, but I keep getting overweight, blah, 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 and all this stuff. So the kind of things that bring people to therapy are usually the things that are not under their conscious control. And by going into finding out how they do their problem in their head, we can actually change the problem unconsciously, and then their conscious mind can be happy about it.
Yeah.
But you don't go through the conscious mind. That's just a way of, you got to keep the conscious mind happy and in your office, but other than that, not that
fair enough. Yeah. And, you know, I think that helps put into context the somewhat surprising or almost counterintuitive nature of some of your some of the tools that you employ. Like, why would I want to think about exactly where a voice is in space and just dial this volume. It's not something that would immediately occur to people, but it seems like that element of surprise is part of what helps work on people's unconscious responses to things.
Well, I wouldn't call it surprise. I think it's just that people didn't think about doing it, and I didn't either until I learned this from other folks. I've only invented a few of these little things. Mostly I've got them from clients and from other people. I just found out what they did inside their heads, and I go, oh, that's interesting, that's useful, I can use that. And then I, you know, dress it up in a little bit of language to make it comprehensible to people. But there are people all around the world doing all sorts of fascinating things inside their heads. I mean, think about the Windows operating system. I mean, the one that Steve Jobs initially created, not the ripoff, but the knockoff. He must have been doing that in his head in order for him to put it into a computer. It's just only one example of a very, very useful system of, you know, these windows inside of windows inside of windows and so on. It's with one of the things that people are doing inside their head, and all around the world, people are doing these great, great things, and sometimes they make them famous and rich, and sometimes it makes them crazy, but even the ones that make them crazy can be very useful. Take something like anxiety, for instance. Often anxiety is caused by a very fast-tempoed voice saying, you know, oh, you got to do it, you got to do it. Oh, the plane's going to crash, or whatever like that. And it stirs up their system and gets their hormones going. Well, you can do the same kind of thing if you want to get sexually excited. You can talk to yourself in a fast, excited tone of voice, and it will have the same kind of effect. Well, a different effect, but it'll work in the same way, in the sense that it builds and builds and builds. So even the things that people do that drive them nuts can be used in positive ways. And vice versa, some of the things that people do that are very useful can also be used in negative ways.
Right. So, and it's funny because most people, pretty much everyone, has the capability to try on different voices and try on a more fast-paced voice to apply to a certain goal, but it might not occur to them. It takes a certain step of creativity or someone who's curated those ideas.
Yeah, somebody who's collected them and is familiar with them. I mean, I'd be in the same position if I were trying to be a doctor. I wouldn't know what things to try. I wouldn't know what tests to run. I wouldn't know what, you know, and if I was a mechanic, I don't know the first thing about cars or what a sound might mean and all the rest of it. It's just a matter of there's a certain layer of a level of expertise that one can get to by learning a bunch of stuff in a given field and then applying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not magic. It takes some hard work sometimes, but it's also a lot of fun.
So, Steve, this is just a side note, but are you a big fan of Steve Jobs and Apple? It sounded like you were saying that the Windows operating system ripped off Mac. Is that what you were saying?
I believe that's the case. I'm not an expert in that department either.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Steve Jobs had his pluses and minuses. I mean, obviously he was a genius, and I know a guy who worked with him on the first Mac, and he had his quirks as well, and I think those come out in a book, which I haven't read. So I really am not an expert on that. But the system of the Windows, whoever invented it, it's a wonderful system.
Understood.
Conceptual system.
Yeah, I was hoping you would come out and just be a fanboy, but I understand. Yeah, it's just right now it's the cultural ethos is Steve Jobs is a big part of it. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I've lived quite a few years and I've seen a lot of geniuses up close, and even the ones that I have respected in many ways had their all quirks. So I don't look. Everybody's got their feet of clay, myself included. So I take a somewhat cautious view of any kind of hero worship.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm in a similar boat, I think. I have one last thought about self-talk and the methods that you've been providing. There are many more in the book, of course. The book is Transforming Negative Self-Talk, Practical Effective Exercises. And the author, of course, is our guest, Steve Andreas. But so here's my thought. Is there a particular sub-community of therapists or counselors or educators who are at the forefront of using and creating these techniques? Do they have like a name or a banner? Is it at all related to the NLP, neuro-linguistic programming community, or is it just a complete hodgepodge of people who are trying this stuff out?
Oh, boy, that could be topic of a whole other conversation. The people I'm learning most from right now are Nick Kemp in the UK. He's got a website and seminars and so on. Andrew T. Austin, I mentioned already, with the one example we went over. There's a wonderful guy in Los Angeles, Ronald Soderquist, who I quote a lot of his therapy cases in my book. There's a sort of a loosely unknit community of people that I respect, and I think the respect goes both ways. I don't know if you noticed in the book, I mention a lot of other people's work in the book, because I learn so much from other people's little discoveries. Sometimes I can clarify them, sometimes I can hone them a little bit and make them a little more detailed and specific and understandable, but one of my favorite sayings is an old Japanese saying that none of us is as smart as all of us. And I really do believe that. And to return to something I mentioned earlier, there's so much private practice in the field of psychotherapy that people don't talk to each other, they don't criticize each other in useful ways, and say in terms of, look, here you tried this and it didn't work, and then you did this and that didn't work, and what was your thinking there, and here's how I think about it. And, you know, this is what scientists do. Scientists are always critiquing each other's work, and sometimes personalities get involved and it gets a little bit nasty, but basically the scientific enterprise is, let's do this publicly, put out your data so that other people can examine it, they can criticize it and say, well, you didn't control for this or you didn't control for that, and, well, how about this factor, and so on. But it's a public enterprise, largely. And that's just not true in therapy. And I'm afraid there's a lot of therapists out there who, in my view, are not doing very good work. And some of them are doing terrible work.
Hmm. Well, yeah, it's such a zoo. There's so many different methods and maybe some experimentation that's not being documented or overseen very much. But I'm right on board with you to try to make helping people out a more scientific, a more public, a more collaborative process. And so I think that's a great ending note, because our hour is up. But Steve Andreas, thank you so much for coming on Psych Talk.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You take care too. That's Steve Andreas. He's the author of Transforming Negative Self-Talk, Practical Effective Exercises. I'm Jose Dras Lopez, and you can find more of our shows at psychtalkradio.com.